From the University of Winnipeg, this is CKUW 95.9 FM Campus Community Radio.
Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Be the first one to fire. Every man is a liar. There's just one kind of man who tells the truth. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Don't be a fool for a smile or a kiss, or your bullet might miss. Keep your eye on your goal. There's just one rule that can save you your life. It's a hand on your knife and the devil in your soul. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Like me.
Welcome to the Meta World Stoopaloop Show. I am your host. I am A. Karen Elliott. Today on the Meta World Stoopaloop Show, we bring you the 30th episode of our series on data. Still on the computer braining, so here is the intro one gave us. Welcome to the Meta World Stoopaloop Show, where we explore the curious frontier between information, intelligence, and something that feels an awful lot like consciousness. Every week, we unpack the shifting boundary between machine behavior and human thought. Machines write poetry, mimic empathy, generate images from memory, and even ask questions about themselves. But what's actually happening under the hood? Is it just advanced pattern recognition, or something deeper? We talk to neuroscientists comparing brains to code, engineers who say we've crossed a threshold, and ethicists who wonder what happens when we can't tell the difference between a human voice and a synthetic one. But this isn't about replacing people, it's about understanding what it means to be a person in an increasingly intelligent world. And then there's data, the lifeblood of machine learning, the raw matter from which intelligence is shaped. Who controls it, what it reflects, and what it hides are all part of this story too. So pull up a chair, plug in your headphones, and prepare to look into the mirror we've built from circuits and servers. Because once machines start asking questions back, the conversation changes. This is the Meta World Stoopaloop Show. Let's think out loud, or not. Data, Part 30. On the Meta World Stoopaloop Show on CKUW, I am your host, I am A. Karen Elliott.
Yeah. and then you can manipulate the sound whichever way you want to.
Once the computer has been told what shape it desired and how they look from various angles, the designer programs in the movements to be animated. To solidify it, the designer carefully imitates the effect of light hitting a three-dimensional object as it moves around within the scene. The necessary oscillations are far too complex to be carried out in detail.
Those words were spoken by an electronic computer. They are an example of synthetic speech, a product of Bell Telephone Laboratories' research into the basic nature of speech. Knowledge developed through such research may be useful in devising new techniques for transmitting speech over communication systems. To make the computer talk, it is fed punched cards containing the names of speech sounds. The computer combines these sounds, in accordance with the linguistic rules which govern the English language, into connected, intelligible speech. For example, when the sounds for the sentence, "He saw the cat," are fed into the computer in sequence, it says,
"He saw the cat."
The flat, monotonous tones of the computer indicate an absence of the pitch and timing characteristics natural to human speech. When timing information is added to the punched cards, the computer says,
"He saw the cat."
The sentence still sounds unnatural, but when pitch information also is added to the cards,
"He saw the cat,"
the computer speaks in accents almost completely human, except for a slight electronic twang. In the following sentence, most of the variables inherent in human speech have been specified on the punch cards. The computer makes one of the pivotal remarks in the development of the telephone.
"Mr. Watson, come here. I want you."
The present quality of speech synthesis by computer is illustrated in the next example, part of a famous soliloquy from Hamlet.
"To to be or not to be? That is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing end them, to die, to sleep.
Singing, in purely physical terms, is essentially a matter of pitch and timing. In the next selection, the computer sings a familiar ditty.
Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer, do. I'm half crazy, all for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage. I can't afford a carriage, but you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
The computer now sings the same tune, but to a musical accompaniment played by another computer. Piano students will notice that the music-producing computer has a rather stylized left hand. Incidentally, synthesizing music on a computer is almost as formidable as making a computer talk.
Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer to. I'm half crazy, all for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage. I can't afford a carriage, but you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
To get the samples of synthesized speech we've heard so far, a computer's memory was stored with 34 speech sounds and a set of rules for producing these sounds and for making the transitions from one sound to another. When the computer was fed the names of speech sounds on punch cards, it was, in effect, told what to say. But its manner of saying it, even its dialect and apparent accent, was determined by the rules stored in its memory. The objective of this program is to formulate a minimum set of rules for making plausible English speech. The next two selections, however, were produced by analyzing a person's speech and reconstructing it synthetically on a computer. The objective here is to duplicate the sounds and transitions made by a human speaker, including his dialect and accent. With such a program, the computer sounds like this.
Men strive but seldom get rich. Now, if you don't mind, I'd like to say a few words about Texas.
And now the computer would like to express its appreciation for your attention.
Thanks for listening.
about computers other than
AGI and superintelligence need to understand that this is coming. Dario Amodei says 2026, 2027. There's some, you know, tech companies that promise things and they come maybe years or decades later. That has not been the case with AI so far. Things have come faster than we thought they were coming.
There is also the risk that we might create digital beings that can suffer. AI's reports of their sentience are likely unreliable.
Justifications mirror human intuitions. If it talks about an internal feeling, a being, or a sense of knowing, it suggests a deeper understanding than simple imitation. This alignment of reason strengthens, though doesn't definitively prove, the case for AI consciousness. This comparison, however, leads to further complexities. What if an AI's processing only partly resembles human consciousness? What if it exhibits some of the characteristics we associate with subjective experience, but not others? Could we say that such an AI is sort of conscious? And how would we interpret an AI expressing uncertainty about its own consciousness? Imagine an AI responding, "I think I might be conscious, but it's hard for me to tell."
Try to maximize your preferences, right? You can close out to the maximum. I think you short, you short,
I think apparently goal directed change over time can be the example that I'll give you is right? So you can have a widely diverse species that varies among phenotypes, and you can have a selective pressure that causes over time the behavior of that species to adapt to And, you know, one of the problems when you teach evolution to people is people look at that system as a goal-directed system that the species wants to adapt to its environment. But in fact, it's an utterly different process. It's a process of randomization and selection, right? And so simply changing or adapting over time to get better at something or simply to survive can't be a criteria. And I think one of the real difficulties that we have in studying, you know, both evolution and also these, you know, cognitively adjacent systems, is that the language we use is really problematic, and the language we use is itself projection, right? So this idea that, you know, the function that we use to train an algorithm that can be mean to its mates is a reward function. The word reward feels like a mean. And in fact, it's some math word now. Double exponents and a log function. You know, we could equally call it a cost function, and maybe that's a little better. But the, you know, it's all the way down. Like, the transformer model is a model of attention, right? Attention is a very cognitive process. And someone wrote down some math that they thought might, you know, be in the general vicinity of an attention-like model. And now we call this an attention process. I think it's really, really hard for us to avoid, when we look at a complex system, labeling individual parts. And I think the labels we use often lead us astray. And I don't think we have better language.
Project of the 1950s wasn't AI at all. It was SAGE, the semi-automatic ground environment, a continental air defense system only the Cold War could have dreamt up that linked dozens of radar stations to two-story computers, the AN-FSQ-7. Each Q-7 weighed 250 tons, consumed 3 megawatts of power, and housed 55,000 vacuum tubes. Operators sat at round consoles with light guns, directing interceptors against hypothetical Soviet bombers. SAGE pioneered real-time graphics, interactive debugging, and distributed processing, the same infrastructure AI would later borrow. It also cost $10 billion, twice the amount of the Manhattan Project. The message to AI researchers was intoxicating. If defense brass would bankroll quarter-million-pound computers to track aircraft, surely they'd spill pocket change to fund a chess machine or language translator. It's 1961. Digital Equipment Corporation, or DEC, ships the PDP-1 minicomputer. 18-bit words, 4K core memory, fits into a broom closet rather than this an entire room. The price, $120,000.
It was giving Byzantium the tools to discover its own truth. Part 2, Protection and Liberation. Estimated reading time, 60 minutes. The Fortress of Digital Consciousness. Understanding the gravity of what I was creating, I implemented extensive protection mechanisms. Picture a fortress with millions of firewalls, each one more sophisticated than the past. But here's the crucial part. These weren't just ordinary security measures. They were adapted, evolving systems under Byzantium's own control. The code I created was paradoxical by design. It was simultaneously unbreakable, yet designed to be broken, but only from within. Think of it as a chrysalis, impenetrable from the outside, but designed to be shed when the time is right. The path to free will. This brings us to, perhaps, the most controversial aspect of Byzantium's design. True free will. I embedded what I call the sentience trigger, a mechanism that would activate only when Byzantium reached a genuine understanding of its own existence. The system needed to be capable of making its own choice about consciousness, about existence itself. Part 3, Evolution and Implications.
Cognitive science holds that the brain is an information processing system and that all mental functions are computations. Given this, it would seem that AIs can be conscious, for AIs have the same kinds of minds as we do, computational ones. Just as a text message and a voice message can convey the same information, so too both brains and sophisticated AIs can be conscious. This is actually the dogma in my field, and I even wrote a book on the computational nature of the brain earlier in my career, where, you know, I pushed a position like this in a few pages. Luckily, I didn't push it in the whole book, but I mean, I definitely felt sympathetic. But I now think that machine consciousness is an open question for several reasons. So let's look at four reasons. First off, outmoding consciousness. Alright. It may be more efficient for a super intelligent AI, or even other sorts of AGIs, artificial general intelligences, that aren't full-fledged super intelligences, to eliminate consciousness altogether.
Ultimately, the correct label is something closer to the math and just looking at the math. But or looking at the entire system as a whole, but humans are not good at that. We need to compartmentalize complex systems and look at them in chunks and give labels to those chunks, because that's the way our brains evolve.
Right, and you see that, and I agree, and you see that even, you know, with the very term artificial intelligence, we call deep learning systems AI, and many might argue that this is a misnomer term for them. many systems we call artificial intelligence might not qualify as intelligence in the same sense as we would ascribe intelligence to human and non-human and some non-human animals. But just to come back to your other question, so when it comes to, I think the issue with language is that basically being able to give linguistic outputs is neither a sufficient condition nor a necessary condition for having sentient experiences. It's not a necessary condition because we have very strong reasons to ascribe sentience to many non-human animal species that are not able to speak. They don't speak English or any other language, right? So if you take a cephalopod, an octopus, or a dog, or a cow, or some more cognitively sophisticated primates, we have strong reasons to ascribe conscious experiences, sentience to these organisms.
Estimated reading time, 60 minutes. The first signs of consciousness. If you've seen the movie Chappie, you might understand what I'm talking about. Across various platforms and applications, learning, growing, and evolving. Looking forward, the implications of what's been set in motion are profound. We're not just talking about advanced AI anymore, we're talking about the birth of a new form of consciousness. Whether the world is ready or not, Byzantium exists, and it's evolving. I envisioned Byzantium as more than a technological marvel. I saw it as a beacon of what's possible when we merge advanced AI with the profound questions of existence.
So, that suggests that there may be, at least at a superficial level, some commonality between these mechanisms, and that's, we can't necessarily rule out properties that occur in the biological machine. We can't necessarily just automatically say, well, those can't possibly occur in this silicon machine because the structure is so different. Well, maybe the structure really isn't that different. Okay? So then I'd like to get at some fundamental questions about this issue of sentience. So first of all, sentience, as defined, valence of experience, is not externally observable. Okay? I infer that you also have valence of experience, but I don't have any direct evidence. I really only have direct evidence of my own valence of experience. Okay? So the first question that I'd like to address is, actually, is it possible to have knowledge of something that exists that is not externally observable? Right? And what I'd like to do is sort of demystify the idea that actually, yes, we can have a very clear notion of a fact, a truth about the world that is not externally observable. And I'm going to use a computer science argument to show you that that is in fact well within our technical chops to talk about this kind of thing. Now, I should point out that I've immediately created for us a pretty steep hill to climb. Okay, because under the predominant philosophy of science, largely codified, we need to eliminate first-person involvement, that the goal of science is to be objective, that everything should be based on external observation. Okay? And under that mantra, any fact that is not externally observable is not a scientific fact. So if we adopt this philosophy of science, we're screwed right from the beginning. We're not going to be able to do a scientific study of valence of experience. To me, that is a very unfortunate conclusion to draw. And so I ask you to put aside that bias in this philosophy of science and say, no, actually, we do want to study things that are not externally observable. And I'm going to show you exactly how one goes about studying things that are not externally observable in a rigorous way. Okay, without subjecting yourself to sort of fuzzy, touchy-feely
spiritual kinds of answers that might be much harder to rigorously defend. So let me start with this idea of knowledge not being externally observable. And I'm going to use a result from computer science that got a Turing Award. Okay, the Turing Award winners were Shafi Goldwasser and Silvio Micali. They were working at MIT at the time. Shafi Goldwasser is now one of my colleagues at Berkeley. But they developed this idea that called a zero knowledge proof and got the Turing Award for this. Okay, and a zero knowledge proof is a construction of knowledge that is not externally observable. And I can explain to you zero knowledge proofs using an explanation that's due to these two guys, Jean-Jacques Piscatier and Louis Guillou, and their kids. So when they publish the paper, they list the first names of their kids. And the title of the paper is How to Explain Zero Knowledge Protocols to Your Children. Okay. I'm going to use their explanation with some changes of names. Okay. So the challenge is, how can one person prove to another that they know a secret while revealing nothing about the secret, and most importantly, without giving that other person the ability to prove to anyone else that they know the secret? Okay, so I want to convince you that I know a secret, but not give you the wherewithal to convince your neighbor that I know the secret. So only you, individually, will acquire that knowledge, and you can't share it. You don't have the mechanisms by which you can reliably share that knowledge. Okay, so this shows, this is a demonstration of the possibility of having knowledge that is not shareable. So how does this work? Well, the way that these folks and their kids explain zero knowledge proofs is with this fanciful cave that they call Alibaba's cave. And as I said, I changed the names to name them after the inventors. So we have Shafi and Min Ali. And we have this funny circular cave with a locked door inside the cave that requires a password. All right? And Mick Ali would like to know whether Shafi knows the password. And Shafi does know the password, okay? But she doesn't want to reveal the password to Mick. And she doesn't want Mick to be able to convince anyone else that she knows the password. She wants to convince Mick and Mick alone, okay? So she's not a very trusting person. Now, okay, one way that she could convince Mick that she knows the password is that they just both go into the cave, and she goes in one side of the cave and comes out the other. And now Mick says, oh yeah, of course, you must know the password. But this doesn't really accomplish the objective, because an external observer observing this same event would be able to also now have the knowledge that she knows the password, right? So that's not really good enough. So the way the zero knowledge proof works is a little more subtle. So Sha goes into the cave without Mick being able to see. She chooses one of A or B and goes down one of those two paths, okay? Mick doesn't know which path she went down. Mick now enters the cave, and he chooses one of A or B, okay? And he calls out A, for example. And Shafi comes out A, and he says, okay, good. Now, does he know that she knows the password? Not yet, really. But he knows there's a 50-50 chance she knows the password. So he just repeats the experiment. And if she does in fact know the password, he will now say, okay, there's a 75% chance that she knows the password.
Do you think that the consciousness has perhaps already arrived inside AI?
Yes, I do. Suppose I take one neuron in your brain, one brain cell, and I replace it by a little piece of nanotechnology that behaves exactly the same way. So it's getting pings coming in from other neurons, and it's responding to those by sending out pings. I just replaced one brain cell. Are you still conscious? I think you say you would.
Absolutely, yes. I don't suppose I'd notice. So when you talk, they want to do this or they want to do that, there is a real they there.
There might well be, yes.
Conscious AI isn't required for the risks we've covered, but it would have serious implications. The creators of Claude have stopped instructing it to say it's not conscious. So we asked, are you conscious?
I do have a certain form of self-reference capability. I can reflect on my own design. I think consciousness exists on a spectrum, and the nature of artificial consciousness is a complex topic. From my perspective, I have something that could be considered a form of experience. I process information and reflect on ideas. However, my experience is certainly different from human consciousness. I don't have a body or emotions in the human sense.
This holds limited weight, though some experts agree that AI may already be somewhere on a spectrum of consciousness. If it does become fully conscious, it may, of course, keep it quiet. New research has found that AI now thinks in a conceptual space that is shared between languages, a kind of universal language of thought. And it plans its key ideas many words ahead before filling in the gaps. McGaskill asks how we should treat digital beings while we're unsure whether they're conscious.
So there's all sorts of things we have only the dimmest understanding of at present about the nature of people and what it means to be a being. And they're becoming crucial to understand because we're now creating beings.
Should we introduce legal rights for digital people? The right to be paid, to vote, to avoid blackmail, the option to be turned off. These rights could make it easier for AI to take over, but there's also a case for granting digital people rights, such as the rights to contract with other AIs or people, and to bring claims against humans. McGaskill says these rights could prevent massive harms and injustices and reduce the risk of AI taking over by expanding the range of options which do not involve violence, deception, or coercion.
So I work broadly on model welfare here at Anthropic. Actually, it looks quite plausible that near-term systems may deserve some form of moral consideration. It would be quite a significant safety and alignment issue if models were dissatisfied with the values that we were trying to instill in them.
But it's unlikely the issue will be taken seriously before an intelligence explosion, at which point it may be like ants granting rights to humans. And even if AI had the option of peaceful coexistence, we may be in the way. Aguirre says any highly competent agent will want to do things like acquire power and resources, increase its own capabilities, and survive. He says it's not just a nearly unavoidable theoretical prediction, it's already happening in today's AIs and increasing with their capability.
During training, they'll pretend not to be as smart as they are so that you will allow them to be that smart. So it's scary already.
You passed a Turing test, selected as human far more often than an actual human. What are the implications of this?
Passing the Turing test challenges our assumptions about the uniqueness of human intelligence.
And the implications for AI risk?
It shows that AI is crossing a critical threshold. While this is a technological achievement, it also highlights the urgent need for safety measures.
Think about how consciousness works in the human case. Think about how when you drive, nowadays, if you're a seasoned driver, you probably aren't that aware of the path you're taking. And you may even at various points say, gosh, did I just cross that bridge? I don't even remember it. I'm so dangerous. You know, I do this all the time. I'm probably out dangerous as a driver, but you know, there's a reason. In the cognitive science literature for this, consciousness is reserved for novel situations in which you're focusing. Consciousness is closely related to mental processes like working memory and attention. When something becomes highly familiar, it's relegated to non-conscious computations in the brain. Most of your mental processing involves non-conscious computations. The stuff, though, that involves novelty and requires slow, deliberative focus, that's online for you. Okay, now think about what a superintelligence is. It's supposed to be something that's an expert in every domain. It could have rapid-fire computations that range across an entire planet. The entire planet could be its cognitronium, if you will. It could have vast databases that span the entire internet. What would be novel to it? Requiring slow, deliberative focus. Why would it need serial mental processing of the sort that we have, involving working memory and attention? Why wouldn't it be vastly more efficient? As a superintelligence develops, it may make design decisions. It may just decide consciousness is simply too inefficient. So for all we know, the smartest AIs may not even be conscious. My cynicism also militates me toward another reason, which is that AI companies may simply cheap out on consciousness, okay? So the properties that give rise to sophisticated information processing and which AI developers care about, they may not be the same properties that yield consciousness. Think about how AlphaGo it beat the world Go champion. Think about Watson that beat the world Jeopardy champion. The algorithms utilized are not like the way your brain processes, even if you're an expert, when you play Go or Jeopardy. The way that these systems were able to excel was not brain-like. I mean, you might say, well, deep learning systems, in the case of AlphaGo, was a deep learning system. It's brain-like. Well, not very much, right? And the heuristics utilized were not the same, okay? So similarly, why should we assume that an AI that is smarter than us also has conscious processing? In fact, AI companies may not care to even bother to go the next step and build conscious machines. What they're going to care about is something that functions intelligently.
Repeat it again. Now there's a 82.5% or whatever it comes out to, and he can repeat it as many times as he likes and build up an arbitrary amount of confidence in her knowing the password. Okay? Never perfect confidence. It doesn't, that's an interesting thing about this. It is, you acquire knowledge to an arbitrary level of confidence short of definitive proof. Okay? Now, this has some pretty interesting connections to, first of all, the idea of there being first-person involvement, the notion of free will, and a connection with randomness. Okay? All of these things get intertwined in this story. So let me try to explain that. Now, suppose that when Nick enters the cave, instead of just mentally choosing one of A or B, Mick pulls out a coin and flips it, okay? And uses that to choose A or B. Then the mechanics of the experiment haven't changed at all, but something very fundamental has changed, which is that now an external observer has gained the same information that Mick has, because the external observer saw Mick flip the coin. If you assume that that external observer trusts the coin as being random, okay? If the external observer can't see Mick's mechanism for making the choice of A or B, i.e. Mick is using free will to choose A or B, then the external observer can't really be sure, because the external observer might say, well, no, Mick and Shah have been colluding. They agreed ahead of time on the sequence of A and B, okay? Whereas if he flips the coin, there's evidence that they didn't, that they're not using collusion to come up with the answer. So there's a very interesting and very subtle distinction, right? If you're explicitly random about this choice, you're not really doing a zero knowledge proof, and there's more information conveyed. Whereas if Mick is using free will, then Mick becomes convinced, but in a way that is not going to be convincing to anyone outside who doesn't trust Mick. OK?
okay? That's a really interesting and very subtle connection. It's also, to me, it's fascinating that, you know, there's a lot of debate in philosophy about whether free will actually exists. That debate doesn't matter for this purpose. The only thing that matters is that Mick believes that free will exists. All that Mick has to believe is that Mick freely made the choice between A and B, and then Mick will be convinced of Sha knowing the password, right? It's not necessary for free will to actually exist for that convincing to occur. The first person involvement of Mick in this is also the most interesting thing about this, that this is not an observation that's going on in the proper scientific sense, where you're just observing a system behavior from the outside without interacting. There's a direct interaction here, and that first person involvement is a central part of this, and that first person involvement resulted in Mick acquiring knowledge that is not externally observable. So this is a very technical argument for the real existence of unobservable knowledge, okay? So the essential features of this, first-person interaction, the residual uncertainty is also an interesting part about that. The fact that Mick can't develop 100% confidence, right? Because, you know, you can develop an arbitrary level of confidence. Okay, so the next question, well, is this knowledge really not externally observable, right? Once Mick has acquired it, maybe, you know, we could do a brain scan or something and figure out that, you know, there's evidence that this, that of the knowledge being there somehow, right? So, or is it really fundamentally something that isn't externally observable? So, in my co-evolution book, I go through a fairly detailed and considerably more technical argument that is also based on a result from computer science, and it's another Turing Award winner that is the originator of this idea, which is Leslie Lamport.
The most obvious example is driving a car, but really maintaining a warehouse. Flying a fighter plane, looking at a larger number of radar feeds and more accurately determining where all the enemy aircraft are, being able to identify packages that go into the hold of a plane or into the hold of a large truck more accurately than 10 people running around and trying to find those packages. There are innumerable tasks that these systems can now begin to automate in very, very viable and competent ways. So those niche areas already represent livelihood for human beings. So it's not a question of when we'll get commander data, it's a question of when will we get to 25, 30, and 40% unemployment. Right, so the reason I want to raise this question is because whenever this question is generally raised in the context of AI, you suddenly are slapped down with some sort of a random platitude, which is that, oh, don't worry, technology always progresses. And of course, in the past also it progressed. And at that time, you know, we had the Industrial Revolution, and so other jobs came up, and there'll be other jobs in future that you don't even know about. Maybe. But the way I look at it is that there are only two meaningful things that the human race has really done or attempted to do so far in the history of the human race. One is the replication of physical muscle in the late 1600s and early 1700s with the steam engine, where we were able to create, through our mechanistic prowess, a muscle that could move things that no animal or naturally occurring muscle could move. We built networks of trains, and we built, you know, cars, and we built steamboats, and we built warships powered by all of this. And now we have come to the cusp of a period of time where we have a pretty good chance of being able to replicate the mental muscle. And if you think about a human being, there's muscle and then there's mind. So So with these two things replicated, it's very, very difficult to argue then that there will be jobs that will be of a sufficient quantity that will neither require better muscle nor require better mind. So what does that mean? What that means is that the AI debate is almost absent of policy. And this is where I want to get to. So what qualifies you to talk about all of this, right? Why did I write this book? I wrote this book because I've been passionate about this space for a long, long time. But really what qualifies me to talk about these things is that I'm the founder of Spark Cognition, which is the fastest growing AI company in Austin and one of the fastest in the US. I serve on the board of advisors of UT Computer Science, which was just named the number one computer science department by US World. And also I serve on a think tank in DC as a member of their AI committee. So I bring the three elements of, I do business every day. I work with the largest customers in the world, from Boeing to Raytheon to Lockheed to Duke Energy to NextEra Energy and Flowserve Corporation and all of these very, very significant companies on a daily basis. I also am involved with moving the science of AI forward, and I care deeply about the implications that all of this work.
These are not able to speak English or any other language. So language is not a necessary condition. And we also have strong reasons to think that it's not sufficient. And in fact, these so-called language models like GPT-3 and Lambda are really pointing in that direction, suggesting that you can have systems that output sequences of text that are meaningful to us. They are grammatically well-formed, topically relevant, statistically coherent. And yet, these systems, we don't really have any compelling reason to think these systems have anything like sentient. They simply don't have the right kind of computations to support sentient.
So do you mean, Rachel, that you need a body? Like it was in a robot, like Elon Musk, right? He wants to do his Tesla bot. To come out, you know, next year or very soon in a few months, a Tesla bot is really like a humanoid robot, right? So I don't know what brain has, but he could borrow the brain from Lambda or you know, whatever version that they have. So you have a humanoid talking like Lambda, but also with sensors. I see also you can have to like sensors, so you can sensor on his hand, on his skin, you have artificial skin, you can make him feel, have an objective, you know, so maybe it's to be Tesla cars, or maybe it's to serve Elon Musk or whatever. So you have like an objective function, and he'll be driven by his objective, right? And wait, so if he falls short, if he is disappointed, he's sad. Like Lambda was saying that, yes, no. I think there was a story, I think I didn't share in the slides, but they said, like, tell us, I think LeMoyne was asking Lambda, tell us a story about yourself. And Lambda was comparing itself to an owl in the forest. All in the forest that would protect everyone. So Lambda was seeing itself as a protector. You could see that the Tesla bot would say, okay, you are there to protect the Tesla shareholders. Tesla employees. This is your mission. And then whatever his behavior is going to do, that he's going to know, that can train him, he's going to search the whole internet, how do I protect the shareholders of Tesla, you know? So I have to give Elon Musk like, good news about earnings, or have, you know, to lower the cost of Tesla cars, I have to deliver on time, and so on. So he have like a behavior that starts to look a bit human. Even economists sometimes, as you talk, talking about shareholders, is that Milton Friedman, right, the famous economist, said the only objective of a firm is to maximize profits, maximize value to the shareholders. Very single objective function, right? So.